Big wheels. The future. I know what I will do when I am old. I'll wear a black coat and sit in the sun on a bench in the playground at 82nd Street and Riverside. I'll take a pear in a plastic bag and make it into bits of conversation with other women in black coats sitting to either side. We'll talk about when we were young and when our children were young. A soft, plump mother will come into the playground wheeling a soft, plump baby, and we'll all whisper, "They both look like babies to me." We'll laugh, thinking we laugh throatily. The lovers, mother and baby, won't hear our cackles. They'll have eyes only for each other. That will end. One day, a pillar of air will rise at the center of the concrete circle. A boat whistle will blow goodbye from the docks downriver. Two. The past. Isabel and I went to the park one Saturday afternoon when she was about 7. I was about 42, and Shakespeare is right, we come and go in sevens. It had been raining earlier, and when we got to the end of the stone wall on Riverside, Isabel stopped pedaling her new big wheels, and we looked down on something we had never seen before in this city of millions. "There's nobody here." Isabel surveyed the damp, deserted pavement of the playground set among rocks and trees. "They'll come, things will dry off." Isabel had just arrived at the age of command, and so she ordered me down the hill, then passed me in a rush of clacking plastic to precede me through the gate of the fence that encircled the playground. I walked obediently on the stones under the linden trees, Unter den Linden, a boulevard in Berlin, Dizengoff, another in Tel Aviv. We are all killers. We are all victims. Which is which depends on the particulars. Everything was damp and shining. Isabel ordered me to the proper bench and set off to pedal her big wheels around the inside rim of the circle. I sat. Isabel and I had never before been the only two people in the park. A squirrel ran along the back of my bench. Leap, freeze, leap, freeze. It turned inanimate at the approach of Isabel's clackety-clack against the distant, uncaring traffic. When she got to the far side of the circle, the squirrel came back to life and leapt to the fence behind my head. The park was so quiet, I could hear the squirrel's feet catching on the metal of the fence. We were entirely alone. Anything could happen. "I've got a game." Isabel pedaled around the circle and came to a noisy stop before me. The earpieces of her glasses stuck into ice blonde hair above the braids. My own hair had been that color once. "I'll be the bad guys and you be the good guys, and I'll ride by on my big wheel and you can sit there and shoot me, see?" I sat forward, "Shoot you." "Use the seat." She pulled the seat back neatly off the big wheels and handed it to me. "If you get me right straight through the heart," she explained, "as I come through this passage, yell stop. Then you can be the bad guys and I'll shoot you." Oh, I nodded. Passage. A new word. I remembered childhood's absorption of words day by day, the way of names and causing things to be. She calls tree and it becomes passage, and she moves toward it. Off she went. I held the plastic seed in gun position. She wanted me to kill her. Three, the present. She wants me to kill her. Once you have words, time can be stopped. You never have to say goodbye. As you read this, it is now. I am always in the park. Isabel circles slowly on the far side. I look at the lindens. They are yellowing in patches. Soon they will drop heart-shaped leaves onto the benches, but in the words, it will still be now. Isabel will grow tall and dark-haired and wear tweed suits with chic, terrible scarves. She will learn to obey her daughter, but not now. See how at apogee, across the bare concrete, she warms up to speed by me on this side of the circle. Clackety-clack, braids. She speeds by, I smile, lowering my gun. I can't kill my own child. She stops, looks over her shoulder at me. Oh, I say, I forgot. Annoyed, Isabel gives another command and takes off on another circle around the immense empty park. No one at all is watching. She is circling, slender, yellow-haired, her gold-rimmed glasses flashing. She comes past me fast. She smiles. I smile back. Mommy, you forgot to shoot me again. Oh, shoot. This time I really did forget. She's so beautiful and bossy. I place the plastic seat against my cheek and get ready as she pedals out, around, toward. She whizzes by. At-a-tat-tat. I finally do it. She said it was a machine gun, didn't she? I didn't get you, I call out soon as it's done. What? She turns her head. I didn't get you, I missed. Angrily, she speeds away for another passage. I must not fail her. Out and around, she pedals toward me. I see now. I must free her. At-a-tat-tat-pa-coo, I got you. What? Isabel does not remember World War II or how guns speak, pa-coo, pa-coo. Stop, I got you. She stops. She gets off and drags the big wheel to my bench. It's my turn. You don't have to ride the big wheel, she says, knowing I won't fit. I get up. No, I agree. I'm too big. I'll walk. Run, she says, her nostrils widening. Run. I run. I run around the circle, losing breath, past the slide, the teeters, the sandbox, toward the slide again, my legs ragged, wilting. I abandon the perimeter and run straight across the open space in the middle of the playground toward Isabel. The plastic gun aimed at me, her finger on the trigger, her yellow hair, the pale light glinting off her golden glasses. At-a-tat-tat, I got you, stop! In intonations just like mine, her voice comes to me bumpily, veering past obstacles tinier than molecules in the moist air. I pause with my arms flung out and my hair swings behind me as I come to a stop at the center of the playground. Like a blonde in a spy movie, the one who isn't going to make it. sealed into always by the bullet of her lover. Now it's your turn. start the Q&A. Who has a question? I know it's terrible to have to ask a question. I always think I'm going to ask a question when I go to a reading, and I always chicken out. So. Yes.
Could you read another one?
Thank you. They're all longer, you know. I'll think about it. Yes.
Did you choose the
the child to be a girl, because I thought that it was mostly just boys that wanted to play with guns.
Well, in the playground that I attended, there were a lot of girls riding.
There were a lot of girls shooting at each other.
Well, perhaps not shooting, but...
at their mothers.
At their mothers.
Oh, their mothers.
Yes.
Jane, did you live in New York, and is this an experience in a park you know?
Oh, yeah. We lived in... I wrote this story shortly after my first novel was published. No, that's when... Well, okay, that's right. And my first novel was set halfway, half of it was set in this playground, and the other half in an apartment. And there's a lot of biographical materials, but also there's stuff you make up. I was used to going to the playground and thinking, ferreting out something to write. And then when the book was published, I felt kind of nostalgic for the playground because I didn't go there anymore thinking of what to write. And the kids were getting older. I mean, they were getting this age, so they didn't go to the playground. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
I just was so interested in the sections and the tenses, and I was wondering if you could say how you came up with that idea of playing with that. And
because people were starting to write a lot in the present tense, and I didn't like it. It's kind of pretentious, I think, although now I've gotten used to it. But you can hear, you probably could hear as you move from the second section to the third, that suddenly it's different, that suddenly it's more immediate,
yes.
And you're sort of standing forward instead of back, and
yes.
you're totally... You're waiting for action, and it's coming. So it's not, hasn't been thought about, hasn't been processed. It's raw action.
Yeah.
Yes.
In your reading, it's beautifully lyrical, and so that could happen in the mind, in the ear. That happens in the mind as you read it. But I was just curious. Do you ever read it aloud in your process of writing to? See how it works, or does it just stay on the page and you just know inside yourself that it works?
I started out as a poet. I read aloud in my mind. I mean, I don't speak out. Charles Dickens used to act his out in front of mirrors and do all the conversation and stuff. I don't do that. But I hear it being spoken as I'm silent. I wanted to start right in the future tense, but it's very hard to do. And I kind of fell in love with the line, "I know what I will do when I'm old." I wasn't a purist about trying to move from tense to tense in the story. Oh, that was your question, not yours.
That's
okay. Yes.
Are the stories in the collection thematically linked?
No. The Gazette could be forgiven for saying this is the second collection because Good Night Ladies was really nine stories that already pre-existing stories that were brought, well, eight and a half. Were brought together around a real common core. There is a theme in this collection that is sort of people in kind of inescapable situations, and they're either dealing or sort of not dealing. I mean, this is a stage onward in childhood from. This is the loosening of the child into the world, and the mother is nostalgic for the, you know, for the earlier child. Or not really, that's not true, forget that. Yeah.
The ladies in the black coats, is that coming from an observation, a real observation?
Yeah.
Do you know their ethnicity?
Do you know? I think maybe they were Spanish. Hispanic. They did wear black coats. It was my mother. I took my mother to the playground. And it was my mother who, I said, look, see that woman just had a baby. She's coming here now with her newborn. And my mother said, they both look like babies to me. So you see, it's not autobiographical all the way through. You just pick things up and use them, yes.
Zane, did you copy that down then and tuck it away and use it later?
I just remembered it. I didn't write it down. Yes.
Well, I love the way you brought humor into all that, and it takes me way back to New York many years ago, sitting in the playgrounds with my kids and thinking, you know, these are wonderful people, and they all have individual stories, and I just appreciate you bringing that out. I think it's great.
This was a playground that was segregated by husband's occupation. That is, there were a lot of editors' wives, and a lot of people involved in music. It was very strange. It was a wonderful place, however.
Where was it?
82nd and Riverside.
82nd.
Yeah.
I was further down.
Usually there are a lot of writers who come to these readings who want to talk about writing. Now, where are you? There's one.
So what was it like for you being somebody sitting at the park with stories kicking around inside your head? Do you feel like the writing made you different from the other people? I've started to wonder whether that's even the right question, and whether the right question is, do you think the other people became different from you because you had the stories and you were looking at all of the stuff as raw material as opposed to just life happening? What was it like carrying that?
No, see, the thing is, I desperately wanted to be on the film bench. There were television writers and stuff like that. And this was when women were beginning to work. I mean, I belong in the bridge generation where you grew up thinking you would just be like your mother and then you broadened out. But the generation after me grew up thinking they want to be employed if they were in a lucky enough position. Okay. Would you like to go get something else to eat? I could read you little bits of some stories, but not a whole story. This is how the title story begins. In tribute to the late Yohanan Mofs, this is a friend of mine, no longer with us, who told me his life story as we were walking from the house downtown. The boy who walked to distant lands. What? I missed that, Jules. Oh, sorry. Your mother is going to have a baby, his father says, holding him by the hand, sitting beside him on the stoop in front of the house in Brooklyn with the big trees that were just around the corner and down two blocks. What do you want, a sister or a brother? I want a dog. I see. What sort of dog? A black dog with curly hair. A dog that comes from Africa. I see. All right.
Teasing us.
I am. Well, I was planning to write read too, but then someone told me no. The Color of Trees by Night. Down the hill on the road through woods, the fireflies glowed bigger than either of them had ever seen, casting a blue light a foot in radius and sizzling like sparklers. There's one, they called out, and there. The wider-hipped woman wore the black clothes of Manhattan, while the slender woman sported skinny jeans and a long-sleeved shirt against mosquitoes. Both carried stemmed wine glasses from Anna's dining table, where they downed a light curry and quite a bit of Pinot Grigio. It was dark under the trees. You could not see your feet beneath you. Anna had never brought a friend down here at night or come here by herself, not even at dusk. It wasn't the decades past headlines from the town newspaper, "Meadow rapist drives light blue van," or "Man shot dead intent on meadow." No, it was the emptiness, the colossal absence you can feel in the lowland, even by daylight. Into such emptiness, it's wise to go accompanied by a god of kindly disposition, and Anna had no such deity left, only an occasional curiosity about the nature of things. What, for instance, is the color of trees by night?
It's hard to hear. Yeah, we might need to put the mic back in front of you.
Is that good? You can hear that actually a mic, it doesn't sound like that. Okay. This one's called Pots. You get dumped after 4 years and you look around to find that everything is shut down while you were out. Not only is this boring, but it's also lonely, and you sit there in the neon chill of your cubicle at Wiseman's Cellars in Frank, way up in Burlington, Vermont, thinking, I'm alone, all alone, not to mention practically in Canada. Here's the thing, you're edging out of your natural childbirth years and moving on toward frozen sperm. You don't cry because 43 and counting is too old to cry. You call your best friend, the one you don't see much anymore because she's done it all already. House down in Silver Springs, great job, great kids, her own Mr. Right. Well, her own Mr. Okay. I think that one's maybe too long. Well, we'll see. No. Coming. Repeating second grade. Inscribing Miss Hansen on the blackboard in standard hand, Elizabeth thought she might have made a mistake. This was not her handwriting. This was not her name. Her name was Lizzie. Oh, Lizzie, my Lizzie, as Jerry had been wont to whisper night after night in the city, delirious with scotch and the world that he at 45 continued to believe lay before him. But God invented charm for a reason, which was? I see, you're an audience that likes laughs. Susan, you asked the right question, thank you. Okay. Swimming in the interim. In the interim.
Interim.
Have we got it?
Yeah.
He went for his routine cholesterol test in the morning, and in the afternoon when the phone rang, His new doctor said, "Hello, Wen, how are you feeling?" "Good," he replied, knowing the implausibility of a doctor's calling for a social chat, yet not wanting to be blunt and inquire as to the purpose of the call, as if the doctor were some dinner interrupting fundraiser. "I'm fine," he went on, holding to form, which he was old enough to know did sometimes offer a bit of protection. "You've got some funny liver numbers here," Dr. Stuart Eisenbaum said, stopping abruptly.
Mm. Yeah, you know what crowd we're in.
This is the next of the last one. Set free in Florida.
That's funny already.
What a great audience. At the small condo in southern Florida, Pete's mother opened the door and stood there, bent at the waist. They'd heard about her disc problem, but not seen its effect. "Mother," Pete said, as he made a slow way over the threshold, leaning on his new half walker. His mother said, "Peter." "That's all right, Peter." Referring to which ailment, which reduction of mother or son? Allie wasn't sure. She came in last, pushing the wheelchair she'd loaded up with their bags, glad to be out of the car after the long drive from Vermont. Final one. This is not such a giveaway paragraph. He remembered his life. It was 4 days before he remembered his life. The first day went to hours and hours of confusing travel by taxi, airplane, and bus in languages not his own, so that by the time he arrived in the south of another continent, it was dark and he could hardly stay awake to eat the fish stew and artichokes the conference center's staff had saved for him. Welcoming a narrow bed, he fell asleep at once. I think it takes a while to get into this one. Thank you very much. There's lots of food. You want to consume the food, I hope. Oh yeah, are there other questions?
Mary? I want to run home and read your book.
Oh well, let's part there. No, please come and eat. What?
Will you be signing books?
I will be signing books.
Oh.
Yes, I'll be signing a book back there where Randy is. Yes.
Oh, when did you start your writing career, or your poetry career? How old were you when you started?
Junior high. No, I came in third in a contest. That inspired me. I wrote stories. After college, I wrote stories but I didn't publish. Couldn't publish anything till I was married and a mother.
That drove you to it.
There is a writer named Jay Newgaborn, who some of you may know, who's taught writing at UMass and who figured out, he kept records and figured out it was 33 submissions for a story before it would get published. Or was it 44? 43. I think it's 43?
It was from the book about his brother.
Oh, okay. And that's true. You just endless sending out, and at that time you had to type them. And buy an envelope and all that. And sometime when I was producing some of the family income, I realized you can't live on being a poet. You have to go get a PhD and teach poetry somewhere. And I didn't want either a PhD or a teaching job. So I switched to stories or kept up more with stories. You know, we all like to think you get where you want to go because you did good hard work, but and we don't want to believe that connections count. But I have to tell you that I married an editor. and he said, you know, you should put those stories about the playground into a novel. Where else you go that? And he was visited by an agent who was just starting out to be an agent. And she said, what have you got? She said, I'm looking for books. What do you have? And my husband sent me to Gloria, the agent. And I didn't realize it, but I was her first writer. She was wonderful. That was a wonderful time. And, you know, that's not like connections, you know a Rockefeller. It's more like people in the business who are working. If you know them, you know what is wanted and where to send your stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a shortcut. It really, really helps. Mm-hmm. Food? Oh, I'm sorry.
Your writing is so incredibly compressed. I have to read it slowly so that I won't miss something really important.
Yes.
I'm interested in your revision process. How much do you start with before it gets down to?
I did read Strunk and White at a tender time. Well, it's different. A story is very different from a novel.
Mm-hmm.
A historical novel is different because the research gets you going. How much do you envision? Sometimes you just plunge in. I early on, when I was in my early 20s, I had a job at a newspaper in Connecticut. I was a bureau chief, and I had been writing poetry. And I had to make an 11 p.m. deadline every night. And I learned to type really fast and to write really fast. And that gives you about 10% of it will be good, and then 80-90% will go out. I used to say a fiction out loud as you over here asked. I used to do that, or at least in the inner way. But when you're typing for a newspaper, it's just type, type, type. And it's really good in a way. It does take something away in a way, too. Every once in a while, I try to take a little brain vacation and just wander around and listen to people. And I don't really believe in the use of prompts for short stories because it's sort of artificial, it seems to me. But I like to go around and kind of absorb some things, and then it will meet with an emotion that I already have or that I want to explore, and then it will come alive and grow. Yes.
I've heard it said that actors will, when they look back on their body of work, they see a theme in many of the roles that they've been drawn to. So I was curious, as a writer, are there certain themes that you're particularly interested in conveying?
Hmm. I didn't major in English because I never got the right theme. I only really kind of cared about the details.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was brought up in a very religious environment, so I'm interested in what happens to those artifacts when they become artifacts. I will have to think more about that. I'm interested in women, women's lives and women's stuff, but I find I'm kinder when I write as a man, when I'm writing a man.
You mean kinder to the male characters?
I think so. I make them kinder than the women. I don't know why that is. And that's not against the women, it's just maybe I feel more kindly to them. No, that's not true. Thank you, that's a good question. I'm not answering it well, but I'll call you up on the answer.
Let's just hope that you're just not finished with your body of work and it's too soon to look back.
Very good, very good. I have set aside for old age, which is upon me, an autobiographical novel that I started when I first went to the McDowell Art Colony some long time ago in the 70s. I hope to be able to. It's been a very difficult novel because autobiographical stuff is difficult because it rings a bell. Everything you say rings a bell with you and nobody else. You know, you're not out there. You're not trying to present it for the curiosity or affection of the reader. You are just trying to say, this is what happened, and, you know, to me, don't you know? And so you, so it's important to be very stern. You look hungry.
So are you.
But it's 8 o'clock, isn't it? Am I not seeing the clock right?
Yeah, thank you. I'm right on.